The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
I'm your host, Beverly Prentice, and you're listening to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, myth, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5 at gmail.com. Thank you.
Bloody Bunnies by Bradley Denton. The day I died was Thursday, December 10, 1998. It was overcast, drizzling, and cool here in Central Texas. Brody Lane, an asphalt road between my rural home and the city of Austin, was shiny and slick. A spot in the center of my chest and another on my lower right rib cage didn't feel right. The spot in my chest worried me because I remembered reading about the wreck that had killed the comedian Sam Kinison. Kinison had walked away from his car, then sat down and died on the side of the road. His aorta had torn apart when his chest hit the steering column. I didn't know whether my chest had hit my pickup's steering column. I was still wearing my shoulder belt, so maybe I was just bruised where the belt had caught me. If I had blacked out, it hadn't lasted long. I could hear steam hissing from the radiator. The windshield had cracked, but I couldn't see much else because the hood had crumpled and popped up in front of it. I wanted to get out of there. But first I had to get the zippered black nylon bag from behind the seat. I had to keep that with me, although I couldn't remember why. So I managed to unhook my seatbelt, twist around, and grab the bag's loop handles. A stab of pain shot through my ribs, but I held on to the bag. It was smaller than a briefcase and didn't seem to have much in it. Then I realized that my glasses had fallen off my face during the wreck, so I had to turn back around and paw at the floor with my free hand until I found them among the scattered pennies and Altoids. They were twisted, but the lenses were still in place. I bent them back enough so they stayed on my nose, and then I tried to open my door. It was jammed shut, so I hauled myself across the bench seat and found that I could get the passenger door open about a foot and a half. That was far enough for me to squeeze through, wincing at my chest and ribs, clutching the black nylon bag. Once outside in the drizzle, I smelled gasoline and coolant. My blue Dodge Dakota pickup truck was on the wrong side of a curve, its camper-shelled bed blocking part of the lane and its crumpled front end resting just off the edge of the pavement. On the other side of the road, broadside across the northbound lane, was the silver Nissan pickup that had come around the curve too fast. I had been driving north on my way to buy Christmas presents in Austin, and this guy had come around the curve heading south. He'd started fishtailing off the road, had overcorrected, and then slid across into my lane. I had tried to get around him, but his rear axle had swung into my grill like a battering ram. I had been going about 40 miles per hour, and he had been sliding toward me faster than that. As I stood there with my nylon bag in hand and my glasses askew, wondering whether my aorta was entering into my chest, I looked over at the Nissan and saw that his cargo bed had caved in where it had hit my Dodge. But its cab hadn't been touched, and the driver stood beside it, looking sheepish. He was a young guy in a letter jacket. He tried to smile at me, but he knew he had screwed up. "Are you okay?" he asked. I could hear the mingled hope and fear in his voice, but all I could say was tell him the truth. "I don't know," I said. Then I turned away and stumbled northward along the left edge of the road, staring west past the ditch and the barbed wire fence at the scrubby field beyond. I saw something big and brown moving behind a clump of twisted cedar, so I clutched the nylon bag tighter and walked faster. Then the brown thing vanished, but I kept walking. I didn't know where I was going, just as I didn't know why it had been important for me to take the nylon bag from the truck. My chest and ribs hurt with every step, but I was afraid of what might happen if I stopped. As long as I was in motion, I told myself, I was still alive. A telephone repair van approached from the north, slowed, and pulled over in front of me. So I had to stop after all. I asked the van's driver to call the sheriff, and then I looked back south through drizzle-specked lenses. My Dodge's rear hazard lights were flashing, but I didn't remember turning them on. I did remember, however, that I would need my driver's license and insurance card when the law arrived, so I went back and rooted around on the floor of the cab again until I found my wallet. Then I paced back and forth in front of the truck's crushed front end and watched green coolant trickle away through the gravel under the radiator. A good old boy in a crew cab Ford drove up and offered to use his truck to push my wreck far enough off the road for traffic to pass. I took him up on it and tried to put the Dodge in neutral, but the transmission had locked up. The good old boy did it anyway, though. I had to shout to stop him from pushing me all the way into the ditch, which was deep on that side of the road. A few minutes later, a Travis County Sheriff's deputy showed up, along with two tow trucks. The deputy asked me if I wanted an ambulance, but I didn't. I had decided by then that my aorta was still intact. My ribs hurt worse than my chest. Then the telephone van driver let me use his mobile phone to call my wife, Barb, at home. I told her I was only 3 miles from our house, and she said she'd be right there. The tow trucks hauled my Dodge and the other guy's Nissan to a nearby church parking lot, where the deputy took our statements and determined that the other guy was at fault. Barb showed up in her Saturn before the deputy had finished his paperwork. She had been heading for the curve but spotted us in the church lot, so I got into the car with her to wait. I was glad to see her. She pointed at the black nylon bag on my lap. "What's that?" she asked. I had been hoping she would know because I still couldn't remember, but I didn't want to open the bag to find out just yet because it might contain a Christmas present that I'd hidden in the Dodge so Barb wouldn't see it. "A secret," I said. The deputy came over then, returned my license and insurance card, and told me where my wrecked truck would be towed. He also suggested I see a doctor just to be on the safe side. I thanked him, and then Barb drove us home. On the way, I put my insurance card back into my wallet and started to do the same with my license, but its photo made me stop. The photo was of me, all right. Same dark straw hair and beard, same farm boy face, but I wasn't wearing my glasses. "This is weird," I said. "I only take off my glasses to sleep." Barb glanced at me. "They made you take them off for the picture when you went for your renewal. You thought it was weird then, too." Now I was afraid that I had hit my head in the wreck and lost part of my memory. My head didn't hurt, but I couldn't remember what was in the nylon bag or taking off my glasses for the driver's license photo. I started probing my scalp with my fingers as Barb pulled the Saturn into our garage, but I couldn't find any bumps or sore spots. "What's wrong?" Barb asked. I stopped probing my scalp and then I replaced the unfamiliar license in my wallet. "Nothing," I said, "just checking for contusions." "We're calling for that doctor's appointment now," Barb said. So we went into the house, made the call, and arranged an appointment for the next morning. Then I went back to the small bedroom that serves as my office, ostensibly to hide the Christmas surprise that was inside the nylon bag. My 14-year-old black lab Irish setter dog, Watson, was asleep on the office floor and didn't wake up when I came in. I closed the door and sat down at my desk, then cleared away a stack of papers and books to make room for the bag. I sat there staring at it a while. What if I opened it, discovered what was inside, and still didn't remember why it was important? What if a chunk of my memory really had disappeared? What if I couldn't remember the names of my friends or family? What if I had forgotten how to touch type or when to flush? I told myself I was being ridiculous, didn't believe it, and unzipped the bag anyway. Then I looked inside, let out my breath, and grinned. Of course I knew what it was and why I had taken it from the truck even before retrieving my wallet. I also knew why Barb hadn't recognized the bag. She had agreed that we needed to protect our pets and home, but she didn't approve of carrying weapons in our vehicles. So I hadn't told her when I'd stashed one in the Dodge and another in the Saturn. I took the weapon from the bag to make sure it hadn't been damaged in the accident. The thin metallic barrel still flared into a neat parabola at one end and tapered into a black plastic hand grip at the other, with no dents or dings in between. The three-position switch above the trigger still clicked from E to O to C and back again. and the arming switch in the hand grip still worked too. The red LED above the trigger came on, and the green LED beside it began glowing a few seconds later when the unit was charged. My Emu pistol was still in good shape, and that might mean my memory was too. I felt much better. It didn't last. For one thing, my ribs gave me a pang as I set down the Emu pistol and stood up from the desk. And then as I went into the hallway, our gray cat Rufus came sauntering out from the master bedroom and rubbed against my ankle. That might not sound like a problem, but it was. Rufus had been dead for 2 years. Barb came running as I yelled, and Rufus looked up at me as if he thought I was brain damaged. And I was fairly certain I was. Rufus sure didn't look dead anymore. What? Barb asked. I pointed at Rufus. He's alive, I said. Barb looked at Rufus, then at me, then at Rufus. When wasn't he? 2 years ago, I said. 2 years ago when he was 10, when he went outside and... I stopped myself. Somebody here was a few bubbles off true, and the circumstantial evidence was pointing toward me. So I didn't say what I knew had happened 2 years ago. Rufus had died when a lone emu had pushed open the gate in our chain-link fence, come into the backyard, and killed him. When what? Barb asked. I shook my head. Nothing. I'm just rattled from the wreck. Barb squeezed my shoulder. I don't blame you, but Rufus is fine, and Watson and Clarence are fine, too. Does Watson still have arthritis? I asked, looking back into my office at the sleeping dog. Yes, Barb said, and Rufus is still diabetic, and Clarence is still afraid of everything. He probably ran and hid when you yelled. So, Rufus was alive, but diabetic. It was news to me. I squatted and petted him, thinking that I might discover he was a different cat from the Rufus I remembered, but he had the same scruffy gray fur, the same bad fish breath, and the same attitude of fearless entitlement. That was what had gotten him killed in the first place. Our other cat, Clarence, had been in our half-acre backyard that evening, too, but he had run for the house in a black-and-white blur when the emu had arrived. Rufus, however, had stood his ground. He had probably thought that the 5 to 6 foot tall bird was a giant chicken that the god of cats had sent him for supper. I had looked out the window when Clarence burst in through the pet door, caught a glimpse of the emu in the waning light, and had then grabbed the home protection emu pistol from the hall closet and run outside, but I had been too late. The bird had gutted Rufus with its talons, stomped on him, and vanished back through the open gate, the gate I had stupidly forgotten to latch that afternoon before I could get close enough to scramble its tiny murderous brain. Now, though, the cat that I had buried by the live oak tree at the end of the yard was purring as I petted him and batting at my hand when I tried to stop. But I had to stop anyway, because squatting wasn't doing my ribs any good. I thought about going down to the tree to see whether the grave was still there, but decided that was a bad idea. How about lunch? Barb asked. Sure, I said, I'll make it. I wasn't hungry, but I didn't want to try to write, and making lunch was a good way to avoid it. I burned 3 grilled cheese sandwiches before giving up and starting a salad. Then, while looking for croutons, I came across a bag of syringes. Honey, I yelled, are you on junk? Excuse me? Barb called from the living room. Then I saw that the label on the bag said, for Rufus, cat, 4 units, once daily. Of course, if Rufus was diabetic, he needed insulin. I mean, have you given Rufus his shot today? I yelled. No, you said you'd do it as usual when you got back from Christmas shopping. So giving Rufus his insulin was my job. But I had no memory of ever doing it. Still, how hard could it be? I found a vial of insulin in the refrigerator, figured out how to fill the syringe to 4 units, and then grabbed Rufus and discovered how hard it could be. But I managed, and I would do the same thing, I told myself, with any other mental gaps that presented themselves. I would spackle the holes in my memory one by one until they were invisible again. After lunch, I took the garbage to the compost heap and found that being outside made me paranoid. Even though no emus had come near our yard since the one that had killed Rufus, an event which apparently hadn't happened in the first place, I was convinced that I could hear a whole flock of them pushing through the trees and brush behind our fence. So after dumping the garbage, I went back to the house and closed the pet door after checking to see that Watson and the cats were inside. Then I went to the hall closet. My plan was to arm myself, then go out behind the fence and either brain scramble or scare off the birds that I knew were back there. But the emu pistol that we kept in the closet was gone, and so was its holster. Even the hook that the holster had hung from was missing. My paranoia worsened. With a sore spot in my chest aching and my ribs feeling as if they were wrapped around a steak knife, I went into the garage and reached under the Saturn's passenger seat. All I found were a wadded Kleenex and an empty Butterfinger wrapper. I rushed back into the house and almost shouted to Barb that two of our emu pistols were missing, but stopped myself. She was reading a book, and there was no point in alarming her, especially since she hadn't even known about the pistol I'd hidden in the Saturn. Barb had never believed that the emu threat in our area was serious, since most of the flock sightings and the worst of the attacks had taken place far out in the hill country. And since I had only caught an uncertain glimpse of the emu that had killed Rufus, she had always suspected a bobcat or raccoon. But I had known better, so I had bought two extra pistols beyond the one provided by the state, so we'd have protection away from home. We lived close to Austin, but not so close that lone emus or ostriches separated from their hill country flocks couldn't cause trouble for someone changing a flat tire. Now two of our three pistols were gone, but since I remembered buying the extras because of Rufus's death, and now Rufus wasn't dead, maybe we'd never had more than one in the first place. I went into my office and found the pistol I'd taken from the Dodge was still on my desk, charged and ready to go because I'd left the arming switch on. So I took it outside and tramped around behind our fence until I was satisfied there were no emus lurking about. Then I returned to the house and opened the pet door so Watson, Rufus, and Clarence could have access to the backyard again. Clearly, both my paranoia and my memory problems have been caused by stress from the wreck. So my theory now was that Rufus's death had occurred in a hallucination I'd had during a blackout after the impact with the Nissan. The memory seemed much more real than that, but perhaps that was only an indication of how hard the two trucks had collided. As I finished taking the plastic slide out of the pet door to open it, I heard Barb's voice behind me. "What the heck is that thing?" she asked. I turned and saw that she was pointing at the emu pistol, which I had laid on the floor while opening the pet door. I could tell from Barb's tone of voice that she wasn't kidding. She really didn't know what it was. Great. I could have told her the truth, but there was no point in that. If the truth could have made sense to her, she would have known it in the first place. "It's a toy," I said. "I found it in the backyard. One of the neighbor's kids must have thrown it over the fence." "Oh," Barb said. Then she looked at me with concern. "You probably don't feel like working. Want to watch a video?" "You bet. Pick one out and I'll be right there." Barb went to select a movie and I switched off the emu pistol and put it back into its nylon bag in my office. Then I joined Barb in the living room and we watched a Bill Murray film, Groundhog Day. I tried to take comfort from the fact that I recognized the plot, but I didn't succeed. In the Groundhog Day that I remembered, Bill Murray had been bald. In this one, he had hair, but it looked as if it had been applied with a glue gun. That night, I tried to stay awake because I was afraid to fall asleep. I was afraid that I was still in my truck at the moment of impact, and that instead of Rufus's death, it was my whole waking life since the wreck that had been a hallucination. If I fell asleep, the hallucination would be over, and so would my life. But despite my best efforts and the pain in my side, I finally did sleep. I dreamed of trying to run away down Brody Lane while being pursued by a thundering flock of ostriches, which, as most people know, can be even more dangerous than emus. I woke up on Friday morning, so I was either still alive or still hallucinating during the split second before my death. But I didn't have time to try to figure out which, because Barb rousted me from bed to drive me to the doctor's office in Austin. It was another gray, drizzly day, and I clenched the armrest all the way to town. Barb went into the examination room with me. She wanted to stay close, both to keep me calm and to find out whether I was seriously damaged. I was curious about that myself because I still didn't feel square to the world. My toothpaste had tasted odd that morning, like peppermint instead of cashews, and it had freaked me out a little. The doctor asked a lot of questions, squeezed my ribs, which hurt, thumped my chest, which was feeling better, and then sent me down the hallway for an X-ray. Barb came along and we waited outside the X-ray room until a technician appeared and called my name. I went in and Barb stayed outside as a technician closed the door. Inside the small room was a white table, and suspended over it was a gigantic machine that could have been a prop in a 1935 Universal horror movie. "What the heck is that thing?" I asked. The technician gave me a quizzical look. "It's the X-ray machine." I stared at it. "I've had X-rays before," I said, "and the machines weren't anything like this. This looks like something an evil genius would use to torture James Bond." The technician chuckled. "Just take off your shirt and lie face down on the table." "I'm not kidding," I said. "The last X-ray I had was about 8 years ago, and the machine was the size of a Polaroid camera." The technician raised an eyebrow. "I think that probably was a Polaroid camera. Take off your shirt and lie face down, please." I did as I was told. It was painful to lie on my belly, and I gritted my teeth as the technician fiddled with knobs and switches on the contraption above me. Then he inserted a piece of film the size of a cookie sheet into a slot in the table. "It wasn't a Polaroid," I said, wincing. The radiologist had me stand against the wall, and then she picked up the unit and pushed a button. The film came rolling out from the bottom. I thought they were all like that. "Okay," the technician said. "Don't move." Then he took a heavy apron from a peg on the wall, put it on, and stepped behind a metal partition. He peered at me through a window that looked as if it belonged on a space capsule. "Take a deep breath and hold it," he said. I had a bad feeling about all this. "Why are you standing way back there?" I asked. "Because I do this 30 times a day," he said, as if speaking to a three-year-old. "The lead apron and the barrier protect me from too much radiation." His explanation only made my bad feeling worse. "Hey, I'm lying here without even a shirt. What's protecting me?" "Take a deep breath and hold it." I was beginning to freak out a little more than I had from the peppermint toothpaste. "Do you expect me to talk, Goldfinger?" I cried. "No, Mr. Denton," the technician said. He sounded annoyed. "I expect you to take a deep breath and hold it." I took a deep breath and held it, convinced that the next thing I felt would be a laser beam slicing through my spine. But there was only a click and a buzz, and then the technician came out from behind the partition. He pulled the sheet of film from the table and inserted another. "One more," he said. Then he looked down at me with a smirk. "Think you can stand it?" He sounded mighty condescending, I thought, for a guy wearing a lead apron. 20 minutes later, back in the examination room, the doctor told me and Barb that the X-ray had revealed 3 cracked ribs. She wrote a prescription for painkillers, then gave me a Velcro-fastened elastic bandage rib belt and told me to come back for more X-rays in 3 weeks. I told her I'd think about it. We stopped at our usual supermarket on the way home, and I headed for the pharmacy window while Barb grabbed a cart and went to pick up a few other things. The rib belt was tight and uncomfortable, and I wanted to loosen it, but that would have involved unbuttoning my shirt and ripping open the Velcro while on line behind an elderly lady who was there to pick up her blood pressure medicine. It didn't seem like a wise move. After getting my prescription, I met Barb at a checkout lane and helped her unload the cart. It was at this point that I once again began to freak out a little. The kid manning the register took the first item, a can of soup, and waved it over an asterisk-shaped plate of glass set into the counter. Something made a beeping sound, and then the kid rolled the can down the counter to another kid who looked at me and asked, "Paper or plastic?" My rib belt seemed to constrict around me even tighter. Neither," I said. "It's soup." Both kids looked at me dully. "Plastic will be fine," Barb said, giving me a don't-be-a-smart-ass look. But I wasn't being a smart-ass. I was baffled. I could see now that the glass plate had a red light burning beneath it, and the beeping sound happened every time the cashier waved something over it, and the kid at the end of the counter was putting our groceries into flimsy plastic bags instead of sturdy fold-out boxes. Everything except the canned goods would be smashed flat before we got home. All of this oddness, plus my lingering unease over the giant X-ray machine, made me dizzy. I wanted to close my eyes, but I was afraid that if I did, I would reopen them to discover that I was lying on the wet asphalt of Brody Lane with mist falling into my face and my brains dribbling into the ditch. And maybe that was where I belonged, because I sure didn't seem to belong where I was. So I went ahead and closed my eyes. But when I opened them, I was still at the checkout counter with Barb, and she was paying for our groceries by passing a credit card through a slot. That, at least, was familiar. But that was how the groceries should have been tallied, too, by swiping price tags through a slot, not by waving things over a glass plate. The only thing that made me hope I still might be mostly sane was that Barbara seemed to be the same person she had been before the wreck. She was 5'2", with curly brown hair, green-flecked eyes, and a lot of patience. On the other hand, she didn't know what an emu pistol was, and the bizarre supermarket checkout routine didn't faze her. I wished I'd dragged her into the X-ray room so I could have seen her reaction there. I didn't say any of this to her, though. First, I decided I would give my brain a chance to straighten itself out. The tow yard where my Dodge now sat was on our way home, and we were planning to stop there to retrieve a few things that I hadn't thought to take with me after the accident. Seeing the crumpled truck, I hoped, might jolt my head back into place. But when I slogged through the muck in the tow yard toward the Dodge, all I could think was that it was impossible for me to be alive. The front end of the truck was even more crushed than I had realized the day before. The hood had folded. The right front tire had exploded. The grill had disintegrated, the radiator had burst, and the frame had bent like al dente spaghetti. The right front fender looked like an aluminum can that had been run over by a lawnmower. The engine had compacted up against the firewall, and the firewall had bowed inward. The Dodge was totaled, and then some. As I stared at the destruction, Barb snapped some pictures of me in the truck with a disposable camera she'd bought at the supermarket. We had decided to photograph the damage in case there were insurance problems, but now I also thought I'd want the pictures just so I could see myself standing beside what should have been my coffin, just so I'd have visual proof that I walked away from it. And right on the heels of that thought, I recalled that a photograph wasn't proof of anything. You could alter a photograph to make it look as if Abraham Lincoln walked away from a wrecked Dodge. Or was that only true in the world I remembered? Was it also true in a world where groceries were packed into plastic bags, X-ray machines were the size of bass boats, toothpaste tastes like peppermint, and Bill Murray had hair? Barb drove us home from the tow via Brody Lane, and once again I glimpsed something big and brown off among the cedars. So I leaned down to grab the emu pistol from under the seat, but remembered, just as the pain cut through my ribs, that it wasn't there anymore. And where ever I had glimpsed was gone when I looked again. That night, after Barb fell asleep, I left our bed and went across the hall into my office. My ribs were hurting like mad despite the pain pills, but I wouldn't have been able to sleep anyway. Too much in the past day and a half had just been wrong. I closed the door, turned on my computer, and booted up my internet software. Then the modem dialed and logged on as it was supposed to, and I relaxed a little. I had been afraid that this new world might not have the same web that I knew, but so far it looked familiar. Even my incoming email list was loaded with the usual get-rich-quick junk and porn site solicitations, and I still didn't know how my name had gotten on the porn solicitation list. Honest, after deleting the junk and reading a few pieces of real mail, all of them from names I recognized, thanks goodness, I jumped to a search engine site and typed in Dangerous, Texas, and Emus. Then, as I waited for the list of hits to pop up, I took my emu pistol from its bag and pointed it at the screen, as if expecting one of the feathered monsters to leap out at me. I almost hoped one would, because at least then I'd know for sure that I was hallucinating, and I would have the right weapon at hand to dispatch the hallucination. To my initial relief, there were some promising news article hits, but when I jumped to the sites and began to read, a chill spread up my sore ribs into my chest. According to the online articles, a few out-of-business Texas emu and ostrich ranchers had simply released their birds rather than destroy or sell them. And these birds were indeed a potential problem to farmers, motorists, and others. However, what I read made it clear that the emu and ostrich industry had never been an important one in the state, that the numbers of free-roaming birds were few, and that dangerous encounters were rare. The birds were big and skittish, but they weren't murderous. This was not as it was in the world in Texas that I remembered. In that world, the Texas ranch industry enjoyed a boom in the late 1980s akin to the booms enjoyed by the Texas petroleum industry in times past. Emus became lucrative because of demand for their low cholesterol meat and the skincare products made from their body oils, and ostrich feathers and eggs followed suit. So emu and ostrich ranches sprang up throughout the state, with a heavy concentration in the central Texas hill country. Then, in 1991, the Texas beef industry fought back with a television ad. In the ad, a prissy Yankee orders a chopped emu sandwich at the counter of a barbecue joint. As he does so, a group of Texans surrounds him, and a raw-boned hombre drawls, "You're new round here, ain't you?" Then the hombre buys the Yankee a slab of beef ribs, and at his first bite, the prissy guy morphs into John Wayne in a 10-gallon hat. "Now that's good eatin', pilgrim," he says. At that, everyone draws six shooters, yells "Yee-haw!" and blasts holes in the ceiling. That ad, plus the persistent rumor that emus were carriers for various avian flu strains, put an end to the emu and ostrich boom. Most of the ranchers went bankrupt, and they set thousands of birds free. The freed birds went feral and got mean. Something about roaming wild or about the diet available to them in the hill country turned them into vicious marauders. By 1993, flocks of emus and ostriches, ranging from a half dozen to several hundred birds, were roaming through the hills, destroying property and occasionally slicing or trampling people and livestock to death. Still, more deaths resulted, as many of the bullets and shotgun blasts intended for the tiny heads of emus instead hit the people being attacked. To make matters worse, shots to the emus' double-feathered bodies tended not to kill them right away, but made them stomp and kick even harder. Thus, to their shock, Texans discovered that firearms were an ineffective defense against emus. Or, to be accurate, we rediscovered that fact, because the Australians learned the same lesson in 1932 when troops armed with machine guns and artillery attempted to destroy a flock of 20,000 emus that was devouring Western Australian crops. The campaign failed, however, when the besieged emus split their army into squads and adopted guerrilla tactics. In the end, the 1932 Emu War resulted in exactly 12 enemy casualties, and in the decision to build a 600-mile-long fence between wilderness and farmland. That solution wasn't practical for the Lone Star State, but the members of the Texas legislature realized they had to do something. So scientists at Texas A&M University were commissioned to find, one, a way to wipe out the roving emus and ostrich flocks over the long term, and two, find a way for people to defend their families in the meantime without wasting ammunition and or killing each other. There's nothing the Aggies like better than a challenge that involves both livestock and weaponry. So by the fall of 1994, they had solved both problems. The first problem would be handled by airdropping contraceptive food pellets over the thousands of acres of tree-covered hills where the birds roamed and hid. Then, over the course of a decade or so, the flocks would dwindle and disappear. The second problem would be dealt with by a state-subsidized emu pistol, ultrasonic pulse devices designed to daze the birds long enough for endangered humans to either get to safety or use a firearm at point-blank range. A sustained ultrasonic blast aimed at an individual bird's head could possibly kill it, but the Aggies envisioned that most situations would call for blasts fired in a wide pattern so as to incapacitate an entire flock for a short period of time. The legislature decided that one Emu pistol would be provided to every rural household in counties with confirmed feral Emu sightings, and that extra weapons could be available at nominal fees. City dwellers, however, would have to pay full retail, or they could rent a pistol if they just wanted to go camping for the weekend. Unfortunately, the Emu pistol's manufacture and release to the public were delayed by the legislative wrangling. The weapons had initially been designed for use against emus only. But then a representative from Dripping Springs rose to the point that ostriches, while fewer in number, had also caused plenty of trouble. Specifically, they had smashed his carport. So the legislature asked the Aggies if the pistols would work on ostriches. And the Aggies replied that while the frequency required to stun an ostrich differed from that required to stun an emu, the pistols could be built with both. Then a state senator from Nacogdoches described how he had been trampled and spat upon by camels during a vacation trip to Big Bend. Camels, he insisted, were far more hostile to man than either emus or ostriches. And if the so-called emu pistols did not include a setting for camels, he would block the appropriation for their manufacture. Legislators for the Big Bend region were furious, and they insisted that the few camels wandering their districts were relatively tame. But the senator held his ground, and the Aggies finally agreed to include a camel setting on the pistols. Even though it was soon well known that the setting was virtually useless, and that the only way to stun a camel with an emu pistol was to use it as a shiny object to induce hypnosis. So it was that my own emu pistol had a three-position selector switch, and I clicked it back and forth as I searched the web and found no mention of any such pistols or switches. I did find an article about the senator from Nacogdoches, though, in which he still claimed that he had been trampled and spat upon while visiting Big Ben. In this version, however, he blamed a combined group of gay rights and Earth First activists. I began to think it could have been anybody. I logged off, then shut down the computer and sat in my office staring at the emu pistol. Even if I had imagined the other discrepancies, the pistol was tangible evidence that either I or the world had been transformed in the moment that my Dodge had crumpled into a useless bulk. It was tangible evidence, in fact, that I and this new reality might not even belong in the same plane of existence. But on Saturday morning, Barb drove us to Katsy's Deli on 6th Street in Austin, and when we arrived, everything there felt normal and right. We had been going to what I called herd breakfast on Saturday mornings with our friends Caroline, Warren, Bud, and Sven for almost 10 years. And today they all seem to be just as I remembered them from before the accident. The breakfast conversation began with words of sympathy about my wreck, after which the herd shifted gears as a group and gave me grief about whether I had been wearing clean underwear in case of a trip to the hospital. This sort of shift was typical and therefore reassuring. Then the trouble started again. Speaking of underwear, Caroline said, her eyes lighting up the way they do when she's about to plunge into a real briar patch of a topic. What kind of person would think that exposing her thong to the President of the United States was an appropriate thing to do? What kind of president would agree? Bud asked, grinning through the steam from his coffee cup. Warren groaned. Who really cares? The congressman pursuing impeachment, Barb said. They're just jealous because someone is having sex and it isn't them, Sven said. He took a sip of his Diet Coke. I'm a little miffed about that myself, actually. I was appalled and confused. What on earth are y'all talking about? Was there something about this in the paper this morning? They all stared at me. I mean, it's ludicrous, I said. President Ferraro would never put up with stuff like that. Everyone laughed, but I didn't know why. On the way home, Barb stopped at the supermarket to drop off the disposable camera with its photos of the mangled Dodge for developing. I waited in the car while she went inside because I was afraid of seeing anything else that I knew hadn't been in the world before Thursday. I turned on the car radio and flipped around the dial, and pretty soon that seemed to be a bad idea, too. I hadn't heard of half the bands or songs, but then I realized that had been true before the wreck, too. Pop music ignorance was just a function of being 40. I couldn't blame everything else on that, though. So far, this new reality didn't seem to have changed anyone I knew, but I couldn't help fearing that I had changed. I couldn't help fearing that I'd been swapped for the man Barb and our friends remembered, and I couldn't help wondering how they would react when they found out. When Barb returned to the car, she gave me a package of Nutter Butter cookies that she seemed to think were my favorites. So I ate one, and it was pretty darn tasty. But I'd never eaten one before. I'd never even heard of them. I didn't tell Barb, though. For now, I still wanted her to think that her husband had survived. I spent most of Saturday afternoon and evening watching familiar old movies like Casablanca, Body Heat, and Blazing Saddles, and I found no more discrepancies like the hair problem in Groundhog Day. Even so, I didn't want to go down the hall to my office to try to work. I was afraid that whatever story in progress I pulled up on my computer screen would be something I had never even started writing. By bedtime, however, I had almost convinced myself that I was being silly. Each of the things that had seemed unfamiliar or weird since the accident, the Nutter Butters, the presidential scandal, the X-ray machine, etc., had been a thing outside myself, so there was no reason to think that any of my work was anything other than what I remembered it to be. But on Sunday morning, I opened the closet in my office to get a fresh ream of paper and happened to glance up at the shelf that holds copies of my published books. I didn't recognize one of them. My hands were shaking as I pulled that book down to look at it. Its title and dust jacket were utterly unfamiliar. So was its title page. Its content page, though, was another matter. The book was a story collection, and I recognized all of the titles except the last one. In fact, other than the title, I recognized the page itself. It was from my collection, Bloody Bunnies, which had also been the title of a story I'd written especially for the book. A story that wasn't there anymore. In its place was a story I'd never heard of, and the book itself was stamped with a ludicrous title, One Day Closer to Death. That was it. I'd had enough. Who wants to read a book called One Day Closer to Death, I yelled, and who cares if this Blackburn guy bakes cookies or not? I went on in this vein for a while. When I finally looked up, Barb was standing in my office doorway with an expression on her face that went beyond concern. It went all the way to contemplation of signing me up for electroshock therapy. What would a better title have been? She asked. The same one I already use, Bloody Bunnies. Barb frowned. That doesn't sound too good. I was stunned. Bloody Bunnies was the best story I'd ever written, and Barb had said so. I was sure of it. Then I realized I couldn't remember a single thing about it except its title. And that was the final proof. This world was not my world. The people closest to me might seem the same, but too much else was different. Either I was dead, and this was the afterlife, or I was alive and stuck in an alien reality. Either way, I was no longer where I belonged. That left me with only two options. One was to try to adapt to my new surroundings, but in a world where even my books and stories were different, in a world with no bloody bunnies, I wasn't sure that I'd have much luck, so I decided to try my other option first. I would try to find a way back home. I slept through Sunday night because I was too exhausted to stay awake. The only dream I had involved an emu, an ostrich, a camel, and a Harvey-sized bleeding rabbit all attempting to draw and quarter me. Then they gave up, and the rabbit just smothered me. When I awoke Monday morning, Rufus was curled up on the bed 2 inches from my face. I yelped, and he opened his eyes halfway and yawned before going back to sleep. Barb, still in her nightgown, came into the bedroom from the bathroom. "Something wrong?" she asked. "Just a bad dream," I said. "Asphyxiation by a giant bunny." I began to sit up, and pain shot through my right side. I had slept without taking the useless pain pills or wearing the rib belt, but I would have to try the belt again. Barbara was shaking her head. "I don't think you're in shape to drive, but I can't reschedule my interview, so we'll have to reschedule with the veterinarian instead." "Huh?" I asked. "I have a job interview at 9, she said. "Don't you remember?" And now I did, sort of. At least, I knew that Barb was on a job hunt. In this world, too, it seemed. "Yes, sorry, I'm still half asleep." I hoped that would be a sufficient excuse. "And what's this about the vet?" Last Wednesday, you made a 9:30 appointment for Rufus to have his blood sugar checked today. Well, how could I have known that? In the place I had been last Wednesday, Rufus had been dead for 2 years. But since we only have one vehicle now, Barb continued, we'll have to reschedule. Otherwise, you'd have to drive me to the interview, zoom back south to take Rufus to the vet, and then pick me up. I doubt that your ribs are up to it. My ribs hurt all right, but Barb had given me an idea. Our veterinarian's office was only a mile from the site of my wreck. If I really wanted to get back to the world I remembered, I would have to begin at the spot where things had changed, and I would have to go there without Barb. I got up from the bed, doing my best not to grimace. I'm feeling better, I said. I can drive. Barb was dubious. I'm not sure that's a good idea. I almost lost you last Thursday, and I don't want anything like that to happen again. I forced a smile. What are the odds?
After showering and dressing, and while Barb was putting on her interview clothes, I took the black nylon bag with the emu pistol to the garage and slid it under the driver's seat in the Saturn. It was the only thing that I knew for sure came from my rightful world, and I wanted it with me when I revisited the scene of my reality shift. I didn't know what I would do when I got there, but I wanted to be ready if I gained any sudden insight. I was even wearing the same clothes that I had worn at the time of the wreck. Blue jeans, black t-shirt, leather jacket. The only difference was that I was wearing the rib belt, too. After stashing the emu pistol, I undertook the adventure of putting Rufus into his carrier. The carrier was nothing more than a cat-sized plastic box with air holes, a wire door, and a handle. But Rufus seemed to think it was a meat grinder. Each time I got any of his 2 feet inside, the other two would grab the outer edges and hang on. I tried putting him in frontward, backward, and sidewards, but nothing worked. I got a few scratches out of the deal, though. Finally, Barb came out of the bedroom wearing a crisp navy business suit, scooped up Rufus, and tucked him into the carrier without getting so much as a wisp of fur on her sleeve. "You usually don't have any trouble with this," she said as she closed and latched the wire door. "Are you sure you want to drive?" I was breathing hard and my ribs ached, but I said I was fine. Then I drove DeBarb to downtown Austin, through the city's abominable rush-hour traffic, made worse by the fact that this was yet another damp, gray day. But despite the wet asphalt and the countless drivers who didn't understand the concept of hydroplaning, I delivered Barb to the right address by 8:45 with no difficulties, other than constant pain. The rib belt didn't seem to be helping. As Barb opened her door, she pointed at a coffee shop across the street. "Can you meet me there in 2 hours?" "Sure," I said, and wondered whether it was true. If I somehow managed to slip back through the truck wick reality rip into the world I came from, would Barb still be downtown for an interview? And would the I, who belonged in this reality, be able to slip back through as well, or had he died in the accident? "Are you going to be okay?" Barb asked. At that point, Rufus let out a pitiful yowl from the carrier in the back seat. "I'd better be," I said. "I don't think Rufus would put up with waiting here." That answer seemed to make Barb feel better. She kissed me, and I wished her luck, and then she headed into the building for her interview. I turned the car around and drove south while fighting off my sense of guilt by telling myself that I was trying to do the right thing, even if finding my way back home meant leaving this world's Barb a widow. I argued, wouldn't that be better than leaving her with a false husband from another dimension? The veterinarian's office was as I remembered it, and so was everyone there. They were gentle and efficient with Rufus, and they finished his blood work even more quickly than I had hoped. It turned out that he needed a slight boost in his insulin dosage, but was doing well otherwise. He had even gained a few ounces since his last visit, they said. He was up to 11 pounds. That was still down from the 13 of his glory days, but not bad for a 12-year-old cat with diabetes. I was able to get him back into the carrier without help. Then I paid the bill, thanked the doctor and his staff, and took Rufus out to the Saturn. Once inside the car, I found a notepad and pen in the glove compartment and wrote out the new insulin instructions. I tore off the page and folded it, wrote Barb's name on the outside, and tucked it into one of the carrier's air holes, just in case. Then, with Rufus strangely quiet, I drove to the curve on Brody Lane, where I had died. I approached from the north just as the Nissan that had hit me had done, and then pulled off onto the narrow strip of gravel between the asphalt and the ditch. I didn't see any ripple in the air or feel my hair stand on end, but my pulse quickened anyway. This was where it happened. This was where my mangled Dodge had stopped, and where I had stumbled into the drizzle clutching a back nylon bag from another world. There was no traffic from either direction, but to be safe, I scooted over the brake lever and got out of the car on the passenger side. My first step made a crunching sound that wasn't gravel, so I looked down and saw shards of blue, black, and amber plastic. They were the remains of the Dodge's grill and turn signals. I stood there gripping the rubbery top of the edge of the open Saturn door, staring down at the Dodge fragments and wondered what I had been expecting to find. There was no doorway back to the world I remembered. There was only slick pavement, a muddy ditch, and broken plastic. Then a gray streak shot past my legs and leaped into the ditch. It was Rufus. Apparently, I had failed to latch the wire door on the carrier, so now he was out of the car and down in the ditch, chasing something I couldn't even see. A field mouse, maybe. Or maybe nothing at all. I jumped down after him, and when I landed, it was as if I had been run through with a javelin. My ribs blazed, and I dropped to my knees. The air turned a misty red for a few seconds, and even when I could see clearly again, my head and ribs continued to throb with each beat of my heart. Rufus had stopped about 30 feet to the north and was looking back at me with an annoyed expression, as if I had scared off his mouse. Then I heard a loud hiss above me, and I looked up and saw the emu on the other side of the fence. It was huge, 6 feet tall, 8 feet long, and this section of fence was missing 3 strands of barbed wire, leaving it about 2 feet high. The emu cocked its head and bent its long feathered neck to look down at me. Then it hissed again and stamped its foot, giving me a good view of its talons. They looked sharp, and there were 3 more just like them on the other foot. I tried to yell and wave my arms to spook it, but all I could manage was a wheeze, and waving my arms only twisted the javelin in my ribs. It hurt so much, I almost cried. The emu's throat swelled, its beak opened wide, and it let out a roar like cannon fire. Then it hopped over the fence and into the ditch. Its feet hit the wet ground with a loud thud. "Shoo!" I rasped. The emu took a step, and now it was within kicking distance of my face, within kicking, gouging, and shredding distance. I could see in its evil little eyes that it was an emu from my world, and an emu from my world would just as soon gut you as look at you. It had come through the reality rip with me on Thursday, and it had been hanging around Brody Lane for 4 days, waiting for someone to maim. And unless I could move fast, that someone would be me. But I couldn't move fast. I wasn't sure I could move at all. Then the gray streak shot past me again, and the startled emu leaped back up toward the fence. Rufus, in this world as in mine, didn't care that the emu was enormous and deadly. All he saw was a big bird. All he saw was something to chase. Or maybe he was trying to protect me, because even when the emu stopped with its back to the fence and began kicking and stomping, Rufus kept after it. He matched the thing hiss for hiss and swiped at it with his powerful, pitiful little paws, dodging this way and that when he could have, should have, turned and run. Whatever his motivation, the result was that he distracted the emu long enough for me to lurch to my feet and stagger up to the Saturn. I fell into the car, howled as the javelin spiked me again, and clawed under the driver's seat for the black nylon bag. I was mostly insane at that point, but I had one clear thought, screaming at me over and over, "Not this time, not this time." I couldn't get that out of my head, even though I knew that if I did nothing, I would be on my way back home, because as Rufus had run toward the emu, I had realized what it would take to reopen the rip between worlds. I was as sure of it as I was the pain in my side. If the emu killed Rufus, then that one event would again be as I knew it had been, and then everything else would topple back to the way it all was before, one domino after another, as quick and inevitable as a truck wreck. That was why I had to come back to the curve on Brody Lane. That was what I had wanted ever since the accident. But in the moment that Rufus's stupid little cap brain had once again decided that it was a good idea to stand up to a 6-foot-tall psychopathic monster, I had reconsidered. Maybe I didn't belong in this reality. Maybe this wasn't my world, but God damn it, my cat was still my cat, and I wouldn't let him die because of my mistake again. I tore the emu pistol from the bag and made sure the selector was set to E. Then I flipped the arming switch, threw myself backward out of the Saturn, and fell down the muddy slope to the bottom of the ditch again. I landed on my back and looked up through another red haze, but I could make out Rufus and the emu. The emu was still kicking, and Rufus was still swiping and dodging, but Rufus had slowed, and as I raised the pistol in both hands, the emu's right foot came down and caught him. Rufus shrieked as only a cat can shriek. The red and green LEDs were glowing, so I drew a bead on the emu's head and pulled the trigger. The hand grip went from cold to hot in a quarter second, and the pistol shuddered and hummed. The emu's head snapped back as if smacked by a shovel, and then the monster just stood there, swaying and blinking. I kept the trigger depressed and my aim on the emu's head as I rolled onto my left side, got to my knees, and finally stood. Then I clambered up toward the fence yelling, "Die, die, die," or something similar, until the business end of the pistol was right against the emu's beak. "Work," said the emu. Then it fell back onto the fence and lay draped there, staring up at the gray sky. At that point, the emu pistol became too hot to hold, and I dropped it. It landed smoking beside Rufus, whose tail was still trapped under the emu's foot. Rufus looked up at me and yowled. I lifted the emu's foot and saw that Rufus's tail had been pressed down into the muddy soil. It was dirty, but it didn't look broken, and the emu's talons had missed it. I didn't blame Rufus for shrieking, though. I picked him up, hugged him to my chest, and climbed back up to the Saturn. This time he didn't object when I put him into the carrier, and this time I made sure the door was latched. Then I looked back at the emu. It hadn't killed Rufus again, so I hoped I hadn't killed it either. I went back across the ditch and found that the creature was still breathing, so after a lot of grunting and javelin stabs to the ribs, I lugged it off the fence and laid it on the ground. Then it lifted its head, and its legs began to twitch. It would have to be tied up. I used the only thing I had. I pulled up my shirt, took off the rib belt, and wrapped the emu's ankles together. I wasn't sure the Velcro would hold, but it was the best I could do. Then I picked up the cooling emu pistol. The barrel was warped, and something inside rattled like cracker crumbs. I flipped the switches back and forth, but the LEDs stayed dead. I carried the pistol back up to the road, and then I dropped it among the fragments of my Dodge, lifted my foot, and stomped it to bits. The vet said that except for losing a little fur, Rufus was fine. And as for me, I discovered that I actually felt better without the rib belt. Meanwhile, Animal Control picked up the emu. A few weeks later, it was shipped 200 miles north to the Dallas Zoo. Better them than us. The only black mark on the day was that a few hours after Rufus and I returned to the house, Barb had to call from the coffee shop downstairs to ask where I was. All I could say was, "I'm home." And so I am, but the world still seems a bit off-kilter, and I'm reminded of that every time I look at the photos Barb took of me in my wrecked pickup. In one of the photos, there are two of me. I'm standing on either side of the Dodge's crumpled engine compartment, and one of me is holding an emu pistol. And beyond the truck, glaring around the corner of the camper shell, is an evil-eyed emu. I've shown this photo to my friends without telling them what I see in it. As far as I can tell, everybody else sees only one of me. Sans emu pistol. Sans emu. I have no explanation, and the only other piece of tangible evidence has been stomped. So I've fallen back on what most people with no explanation or evidence fell back on. Belief. Most often I choose to believe that the wreck knocked my brain around just enough to result in a small shift in my perceptions, which in turn resulted in small discrepancies between the world I now perceive and the world I perceived prior to cracking up on Brody Lane. Other times I entertain the quasi-religious notion that no one ever dies, but instead pops out in an almost but not quite same reality in which he or she goes on living and driving and drinking coffee and maybe even getting to pet a resurrected cat.